Welcome to another episode of From the Roots Up. My name is Sean Frame, and I'm your host on this adventure. Every week, we try and take on some topics, go deep, and hopefully, you know, get things in our minds a little more clearly on some of the issues that impact all of us. This week, you know, it's really one of those situations where I'm taking on a topic that just has seemed to elude me. It's just too much for me to take in and parse and understand. I don't know how to say it other than that. There's plenty of information out there. Maybe there's too much, or maybe it's just the way that I get my information. But, you know, when I get information on this topic, it always just seems to go in and it doesn't have a place to land and accumulate and turn into something coherent. So the topic is Ukraine. I mean, I've read stories, I've watched the news, I've dug in and even done some research, but for some reason, I just can't get it all into a coherent picture. What on earth is going on over there? Why? Who are the players? And what's it like for the people on the ground who are living there and have lived there? On today's show, well, really our next two shows, I'm going to do my best to get a grasp on this. And I hope at the end of it, you'll have a better grasp too. As always, we'll look at the big picture, but we'll also really try to get at it from the bottom, from the granular level, from the roots up. This episode of From the Roots Up is brought to you by The Torch Club, Sacramento's premier live music venue every Wednesday to Sunday. Check them out at 904 15th Street in Sacramento or online at torchclub.net. All right, we're here today on From the Roots Up with Martin Kuz, who is an independent journalist covering the war in Ukraine. I could say many more things about that, but I think when we get into the interview, you're going to learn about, a lot about Martin, a lot about what I hope you'll learn about today is what I'm hoping to learn about, which is what is going on in Ukraine? What is happening there? Why is it happening? What's maybe some of the historical context that is happening there? So welcome, Martin, and thank you for joining our show today.
Thanks, Sean. A privilege to be with you.
So let's just talk about, you know, in broad brushstrokes, you know, we're almost 4 years into the current conflict where Russia attacked Ukraine. I don't think there's any way to say it other than that. You could call it a conflict, but like it was an attack, and it happened on February 24th, 2022, if I got my dates right. So what's going on the ground there now? And how would you describe it as somebody who's been there multiple times and seen it firsthand?
I think the term that people often use is stalemate, and I'm not sure that I would use that term. I would call it a war of attrition. And what you're seeing on the front line, which is well over 600 miles long, is Russia continuing to press its advantages in manpower and firepower. Russia, by simple math, holds large advantages over Ukraine in terms of weaponry and in terms of the number of soldiers they can throw into the breach. And you know, the plight of Russians is that individual life, going back centuries in Russia, has very little value. And so Russia has suffered casualties at a level not seen since World War II. There is no sustained public outcry in Russia because people there live in a police state under an extreme autocracy in which any form of dissent is treated extremely harshly. So Russia continues to throw tens of thousands of soldiers into the line of fire. And by virtue of that, they are making incremental gains, particularly in southeastern Ukraine, which has seen the fiercest fighting. Ukraine, through its innovations in drone warfare, through its savviness in terms of how it approaches its war tactics, and through its value of individual life, has suffered fewer casualties, but it has a much smaller pool of potential soldiers to draw from. And it also has a older army. The average age of a Ukrainian soldier is around 43. And this has to do in part because Ukraine, up until about a year, year and a half ago, had a minimum recruiting age of 27. It was subsequently lowered to 25. But this deep into the war, now almost 4 years, that will be in about 2.5 months, you have a lot of younger Ukrainians who are reluctant to sign up for a war that is so deadlocked at the moment. And there's a fear that their own life could be sacrificed for what seems like very little. It's an understandable reaction given the losses on both sides at this stage. But Ukraine finds itself in a very difficult situation with respect to pure numbers on the ground in terms of who they can deploy and the age of the soldiers that they can deploy. I covered the U.S. war in Afghanistan for the better part of 3 years. I've been covering this war since it began. And it's no surprise, right? Like anything else, when you're 25 versus 55, it's a lot easier. It's a lot easier to just do things, and you need young bodies to fight ground wars. That's the grim reality, and Ukraine just doesn't have as many of those. And I find part of the equation here. I'll just go on a quick tangent. Part of the equation is that older Ukrainians want younger Ukrainians to have a future free of war, want them to actually experience liberty in a way that they perhaps didn't. The first part of their lives was spent under the Soviet Union. And so you might expect that there would be an outcry among older Ukrainians saying, we must have our 20-year-olds signing up and going to war. And in fact, you find a remarkable compassion for younger Ukrainians and saying, no, let us sacrifice so that perhaps they will have a future that we always wish that we had, which was free of war, free of, more specifically, Russian oppression. So, but it's strictly in terms of the war on the ground, you have a numbers game that favors Russia, and Vladimir Putin, Russia's president/dictator, understands this, and this is also an undercurrent in the ongoing peace negotiations.
We all know that money spent on politicians is nothing more than a bribe. Citizens United called it free speech, but we know better. But what if we could balance the scale a few bucks at a time? That's what we're doing at the Six Pack, taking small donations and adding them up to make things more fair. Crack open some change. Support the Six Pack. Paid for by the Six Pack, which is responsible for the content of this advertising. www.thesixpack.com. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
There's so much in what you just said that I've never heard before. I think for myself and probably for a lot of listeners, it's really hard to get what's going on there when we get very limited reports and they come in little drips and drabs. And sometimes they're contradictory. You hear one thing one day, you hear another thing another day. What does it mean to be an independent journalist and to do this on your own? First, how the heck do you do that? Like, is that, I mean, that's got to be incredibly difficult, also probably dangerous. And also, what advantage does that give you, and what disadvantages does that come with?
Now, I mentioned I covered the U.S. war in Afghanistan, and I did so for the military publication Stars and Stripes. And that was from roughly 2011 to 2014. And that gave me experience on the ground in a war zone that allowed me to go to Ukraine with some degree of confidence that I could stay safe. I say that I'm not particularly brave when people suggest that I am, because I say, look, you know, it's civilians in Ukraine who are brave, soldiers in Ukraine who are brave, because they stay. Now, I have the opportunity to go into the country and then step out. And the way things unfolded in Ukraine toward the end of 2021, Vladimir Putin had amassed in the neighborhood of 200,000 troops on the border with Ukraine. And he had done the same thing earlier in 2021 and then had pulled back. And this time, based on what I understood about his history since coming to power in 2000, I didn't think that he was bluffing. It didn't seem to me that he would stage a second dress rehearsal. Also, the United States had the rather disastrous pullout from Afghanistan. I think he felt that the United States was vulnerable, might not be able to pull together a Western coalition that would support Ukraine for any sustained period of time. So my logic was that Beijing was hosting the Winter Olympics in February of 2022, and that is his closest ally. That is Putin's closest ally. I didn't think he would want to interrupt the pageantry of the Winter Olympics with an invasion. And so I decided to fly to Kyiv. Airspace was still open in Ukraine at that time. I flew to Ukraine about 12 days before the Olympics ended. And my hunch was that we would see an invasion of some kind post-Olympics. And so I spent that first week and a half in southeastern Ukraine along what was then the front line. This was the area that Russian troops had come into in 2014 after the Ukrainian president, who was aligned with Moscow, had been ousted in a popular uprising. So Putin had then gone into Crimea and then southeastern Ukraine. And inside of Ukraine's actual borders was this artificial border that had been created due to the occupation. So I spent time down there trying to get an understanding of what life was like on that front line. And then February 20th or so, I returned to Kyiv. And 4 days later, the full-scale invasion began. I think the Winter Olympics ended three days prior to the start of the full-scale invasion, 3 days or 4 days. And so I was in Kyiv when at about 5:30 in the morning, you could hear intense artillery battles taking place on the outskirts. And in that case, on that reporting trip, I had contacted the Christian Science Monitor, a publication that I had written for over the span of about 3 years, ending in spring of 2021, and asked them if they were interested in coverage from Ukraine or whether they planned to have someone there. And an editor there said, no, we would love to have coverage. And that was irrespective of whether a war began. Now I found myself in the capital of Ukraine as the largest land war that Europe had seen since the end of World War II kicked off. And, you know, though I had the sense that Putin would launch a war, I didn't think that he would go for the entire country. I thought he would try to consolidate his gains in southeastern Ukraine, where he already had troops, maybe try to bite off another region or two. But I think almost everybody was surprised that he went after Kyiv. He went for the entire country. And I had, in retrospect, foolishly booked an Airbnb on like the 17th floor of a high rise. There was a lesson learned. try to stay on the ground floor if you can, if you're in a war zone or a potential war zone. And there were underestimated two aspects in this war. We underestimated the strength of the Ukrainian army. We underestimated the strength of the Ukrainian army. We overestimated the strength of the Russian military. And we saw Ukraine, with Western support, be able to stave off that initial invasion, both through really savvy strategy and just the heroic cooperation among civilians and soldiers in Ukraine. So I spent 5 weeks at that point covering the war, filing stories for the Monitor, as well as a handful of other publications.
When it happened, you must have been one of the only people there who had intentionally gone to cover this thing, knowing almost certain that it was going to happen, right? Like, were other...
There were a lot of reporters who were on the outside looking in. And I would say that I didn't, you know, it was an educated guess. I felt like, you know, I could have easily been wrong. I wish I had been wrong. But yeah, it was interesting. A lot of people were then trying to get in, and it became much harder because the airspace was closed. And I was by myself. I didn't have a photographer. I didn't have security details. I remember one of the first stories I did was I went to the main train station in Kyiv, to talk to people about whether they planned to leave or stay. And naturally, of course, most people there were on their way to either Western Ukraine or trying to get out of the country altogether. I had the connection with the Monitor, but the Monitor wasn't asking me to go. No one had emailed me or called me and asked if I was interested. And I don't think any of them necessarily knew that I had a personal connection to Ukraine. My father had been born there in 1923, and I have relatives in Western Ukraine. So it was, for me, there was also a deeply personal element to wanting to go. And I had, you know, in fall and winter of 2021, I just had this tightness in my chest about the foreboding that war could happen. And it was because of that family connection. And I had first been to Ukraine in 2014, as it happens, the same year that Putin had gone in to Crimea and southeastern Ukraine. And I had seen the aftermath of the protests on the Maidan, which is the central square in Kyiv, where for over 100 days, hundreds of thousands of people had gathered and effectively forced the Russian-aligned president of Ukraine to flee office and ultimately flee the country.
From the Roots Up is brought to you by the Six Pack. Crack open some change and support the candidates and causes we need in these times. Paid for by the Six Pack, which is responsible for the content of this advertising. www.thesixpack.com. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
Fluorescent lights engage like birds frying on a wire.
If you love live music and want to be up close and personal with the band, there's only one place to go: the Torch Club. This hotspot is the place to be, with two shows a day, Wednesday to Sunday. Check out the upcoming shows at torchclub.net, or just drop by 904 15th Street in Sacramento. The Torch Club. There's always something happening. From the Roots Up is community radio that is sponsored by community businesses. If you'd like to join the growing list of folks who make this show possible, reach out to Jenny, J-E-N-N-Y, at khi.com.
The conclusion of that first reporting trip was there was such deep sadness that I felt, both because I saw my father's homeland being again attacked by its perennial enemy in Russia. And also because I wanted to figure out how to continue reporting a story that, for me, is the most important subject I've ever covered. And that was when I realized that I had to come up with ways as an independent journalist to fund my own reporting. And to fast forward just a bit, I made a second trip back to Ukraine that summer. That all came out of my own pocket. And then later in 2022, I decided to launch a GoFundMe campaign. And I initially was going to only ask for $1,500, figuring that that would cover about half of my expenses for a third trip to Ukraine. And my partner, Emily, said, you know, man, if you're going to ask, you might as well ask for $3,000. So she gets the credit. And I was thinking 1500 because I thought, what are the chances that I'm even going to reach that mark? You know, I thought that the embarrassment would be a little less severe. And then I opened the campaign, and within just, I think, a couple of days, I reached 3000, and the total kept climbing. So that allowed me then to make two trips to Ukraine in 2023. And toward the end of 23 and heading into last year, as the GoFundMe donations continued but had slowed, I wanted to come up with a way to supplement my income and continue reporting on Ukraine. My freelancing had gone well during those first 2 years, but I could see that editors were losing interest, and unfortunately, freelance budgets were shrinking. So I launched a newsletter, a Substack newsletter called Reporting on Ukraine. And like I mentioned off the air, I'm one of billions of journalists now who claim that he has a newsletter. But that gave me an opportunity both to ask readers for subscription, for paid subscriptions, as well as write about Ukraine in a way that I felt was more personal, where I could combine my on-the-ground reporting with also perceptions and perspectives that I wouldn't necessarily be able to include in a straight news story for a commercial publication. So that, in a rather large nutshell, is how I find myself now at this point, at almost 4 years into the war, continuing to cover it. And fortunately, thanks to donations and paid subscribers, continue to fund my reporting over there.
Wow. And, you know, kudos to you for taking that risk to open yourself up to that and to do it. I mean, obviously, look, I don't see you becoming, you know, the next Wall Street Journal or New York Times. But, you know, the fact that it is funding itself and allowing you to do this reporting, I mean, that is a good, I guess that's a good, you know, step forward if we're not going to have the kind of massive expenditures on this kind of journalism that all the big publications and even television news outlets used to do, right? I don't see them spending what they used to. So somebody has to step into the void and do this work. So really appreciate you doing that.
I wrote the news today in the tent outside the Midway Rise, and as my money flew singing to their pockets, you could only know your shame knowing what the good ones do. And when you see the bruises on my legs from kicking pills, yeah, then you see how recklessly the pages I fill make headlines, believe them, come back. Make headlines, believe them, come back.
We all know that money spent on politicians is nothing more than a bribe. Citizens United called it free speech, but we know better. But what if we could balance the scale a few bucks at a time? That's what we're doing at the Six Pack, taking small donations and adding them up to make things more fair. Crack open some change. Support the Six Pack. Paid for by the Six Pack, which is responsible for the content of this advertising. www.thesixpack.com. Not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee.
This is a part of a much larger historical context, that what's happening in that part of the world didn't happen just, you know, in 2022 and in 2014. But I mean, there's a big Cold War story there. There's the end of the Cold War that, you know, the breaking away. There's even going back before World War II, our World War II, right? The Great War, there was a Holocaust that happened in Ukraine that I think most of our listeners probably aren't even aware of, at the hands of Stalin. And then if you go back 100 years prior to that, you know, there was conflict going back with the czars, I guess it was Tsar Nicholas, right? So I think, if I'm getting that right. So, I mean, and that's just my, like, I tried to get like a timeline, and I'm like, oh, these two countries, these people have been fighting with each other for a long, long, long time over this part of the world. So how does this fit into that? I mean, is this just an extension of the past just keeps recycling itself, or is this something new? What is the context into which this fits?
I think it is fair to say that it fits into that historical context because Vladimir Putin has explicitly referenced that history in justifying his unprovoked war against Ukraine. He has talked about the czars of Russia and how in the way he frames the story that Ukraine has always been part of Great Russia. And the czars, Catherine the Great, Nicholas I, Nicholas II, they would refer to Ukraine as Little Russia. They would refer to the Ukrainian language as Little Russian. And if you go back to the late, and I won't dwell on this too long because I know people have a lot on their minds. But so if you go back to the late 1600s and moving forward, what you saw over time was the exertion of Russian military force against Ukrainians. And for a time, it was the Cossacks. Then later on, you had independent militias representing different regions of Ukraine who were fighting for an independent Ukrainian state. And Russia simply had a more cohesive government, and thus a more cohesive military. And as time passed, was able to exert itself, not only in Ukraine, but across much of Eastern, what we know of now as Eastern Europe, throughout Asia. And Ukraine's fight for independence, which is something that Putin elides from his histories, is something that has occurred in fits and starts throughout the last three centuries. It had struggled to turn into a cohesive movement that liberated Ukraine from Russia's iron grasp until 1991, when we saw the Soviet Union collapse. But the period of history that's probably most important to understand is from the formation of the Soviet Union in 1922, moving forward. So Vladimir Lenin formed the Soviet Union. Ukraine was one of four countries that made up the foundation. So you can see right there the formation of the Soviet Union. And this is important in understanding Putin's motivation. But the Soviet Union thought of Ukraine as one of its founding pillars. And Lenin is in power for only a couple of years in the existence of the Soviet Union before he falls ill and eventually is killed. And Stalin then ascends to power. And it is under Stalin, in his 30-year reign, that the Soviet Union inflicts untold cruelty against Ukrainians, as well as millions of other people in other countries. And specifically in the case of Ukraine, 1932 to 1933 was a time that is now known as the Holodomor. That's the Holocaust that you referenced. This was a man-made famine that Stalin orchestrated and imposed on the Ukrainian people. Now, Ukraine has a reputation as the breadbasket of Europe, very fertile land. It's an enormous agricultural producer of all of grains and other crops. Stalin wanted to make a great leap forward in terms of the Soviet Union's industrial rise. He used the agricultural bounty of Ukraine to fund that industrial rise by exporting it, and thus then importing all the materials he needed to build his bridges and his cities and his factories, and was successful in the sense that the Soviet Union did make an incredible industrial leap forward. But for Ukrainians, it was a period of profound suffering and loss. An estimated 4 million to 10 million Ukrainians starved to death just in that period from 1932 to 1933, as crops were confiscated and even heirloom seeds were taken from families. They were left with literally nothing. And you had this die-off that was occurring outside, for the most part, of the perspective of Western press. And nobody knew about this. And even to this day, understanding about the Holodomor and awareness of the Holodomor is very, very small. But it had a dramatic effect on Ukraine in the sense that Stalin wanted to break the spirit of Ukrainians. He wanted to crush any ideas of political and cultural independence, in addition to funding the Soviet Union's industrial rise. And he was successful. After the Holodomor, the ability of Ukrainian partisans to mount anything like resistance was broken. And you did not have then the sufficient political will to build a Ukrainian state.
And well, how could you? You just 4 to 10 million people just starved to death. I mean, your people are decimated and terrified too.
That's it.
I mean, that's the terror that rains down on people, knowing that somebody could literally allow millions of people to starve to death or intentionally starve them to death.
Yeah, and it was followed very quickly by massive purges of the intellectual class in Ukraine. So I call the Great Purges under Stalin, upwards of 200,000 to 300,000 people were killed. And he was taking out academicians, artists, writers, all the people of the intelligentsia who could help rebuild the Ukrainian state, or at least foment the idea, nurture the idea of a Ukrainian state. And so you use the word terror. That is absolutely the right word. And the reign of terror under Stalin was so profound and so long lasting. And it did then result in Ukraine, despite the fact that there were still these pockets of resistance, but it did result in Ukraine that was necessarily compliant, because it had been deprived of the essentials of life. And so this was the model that Stalin then exported to other countries, was he terrorized them to such a degree that then when they received the smallest pittance from the government, they were grateful, because it would be just enough. You know, it was the thin line, quite literally, between life and death. And right.
So you become dependent upon that, because you don't want to die, but on the other hand, the cruelty of it is understood.
Yeah, and anything like resistance is met with exile or execution or both. And so through the 30s and into the start of World War II, Ukrainian citizenry was terrified and depleted.
They say they don't know when, but a day is gonna come when there won't be a moon and there won't be a sun. It will just go black. It will just go back to the way it was before.
If you love live music and want to be up close and personal with the band, there's only one place to go. The Torch Club. This hotspot is the place to be, with two shows a day, Wednesday to Sunday. Check out the upcoming shows at torchclub.net, or just drop by 904 15th Street in Sacramento. The Torch Club. There's always something happening.
War starts when in Ukraine, Russia gets drawn into the war after Stalin and Hitler have agreed to partition Poland. But Hitler breaches that agreement, and in 1941 he goes into Western Ukraine. And at this point, Ukraine finds itself caught in a buzzsaw between two monstrous dictatorships, and millions of Ukrainians die as the Germans sweep toward the eastern part of the country, basically leveling entire villages and setting huts on fire, homes on fire, dynamiting larger buildings. But here's an aspect of that history that most people don't know, is that the first wave of killings of Ukrainians when Germany invaded was not committed by German troops. It was committed by Russia's intelligence services. Stalin was so fearful that all of those dissidents that he had imprisoned would join with the invading Nazi
forces. It would be a logical thing to think that maybe these people who you've just starved millions of might see the Germans coming in as their saviors rather than as their invaders, right?
I mean, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And some, so I'm sure some did. Like, I know that, you know, there was a German program and many of the, as they advanced, right, to find the people who would be on their side and put them in charge. They did it in France. They did it is anywhere that they could. From what I understand, they didn't, they would find people and say, you're a member of the SS now, the Waffen SS. And you're, you know, now you're on our side. You're going to be the, we're going to set up you in the government role. And then on we go. Right. Like,
right. They formed, and they did this in Ukraine. They formed units in country after country. And they did. They tapped into fear of communism. And more readily, they exploited that oppression that so many people, hundreds of millions of people, had suffered under Russia and under Stalin. And so
before we go on, I just want to point out, like, is this why you will hear Putin say, or is this just a part of his propaganda, the propaganda machine, that, oh, the Ukrainians, they're all a bunch of fascists and Nazis, right? Like, he will, he's, that's something that comes out of their propaganda machine all the time. I hear it, you know, oh, we're not, you know, invading the country for any reason other than we just got to get these fascists out of Europe, right? Like, is that what it stems from? Is it partially based on that going back to that time?
It absolutely is, and Western Ukraine, the sentiment for the anti-Russian sentiment and the push for independence was much, much stronger than the rest of the country. Western Ukraine and Central Ukraine have always aligned much more with Europe, and the sentiment was based in part largely by the suffering that Russia had inflicted. So anyone coming into Ukraine who was not Stalin or was not the Russian military was going to be welcomed, in part because, as false as the hope may have been, it was some kind of hope. There was nothing like hope under Russian rule when Stalin was in power.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend, right?
Precisely. Yeah. So Stalin wipes out tens of thousands of dissidents at the very start of the German invasion of Ukraine, and Germany pushes on toward Russia. And then in what we see now today happening in Ukraine is what was happening in Russia during World War II. Russia was able to push the Germans back by virtue of superior numbers. Stalin's explicit military strategy was to force Germany to run out of ammunition. So, as we see today under Putin, Russian soldiers who try to desert or try to retreat are shot. So, and Putin has borrowed that tactic. He has essentially a rear line of soldiers to execute any soldier caught trying to flee. And Stalin, I've said this before in other interviews. I mean, Stalin more or less perfected the war of attrition. And by virtue of superior numbers and a bitter Russian winter, he was able to turn the tide. And eventually, the Russians start pushing the Germans back. Germans, on their way out of Ukraine, do much of what they did on the way in, which is destroy every building, kill tens of thousands of Ukrainians. And eventually, of course, Russia pushes Germany all the way back to Berlin, and with the help of the United States and the other allies, wins the war, at which point the West starts handing over a lot of Europe to Stalin by virtue of the victor goes the spoils. He was an ally in World War II. And even though there was an awareness of the oppression that he was imposing on Ukraine and so many other countries, the West essentially said, well, what can we do? you know, we don't want to risk an open conflict with Russia right after World War II. And so the plight of Ukrainians was effectively ignored, not by the Ukrainians themselves. They, in Western Ukraine in particular, the partisans again fought fiercely against Soviet rule. And it's little known, but that fighting continued into the mid-50s. It actually went beyond the lifespan of Stalin, who died in 53. So you had pretty wow. intense skirmishes between the Ukrainian partisans and Russian military. Stalin died, and that allowed for a bit of a detente. So it was put down by force. Russian military did eventually essentially kill the Ukrainian movement for an independent state. But Khrushchev, who came in after Stalin, took a different approach. He was much less harsh overall in how he approached Ukraine. And it was Khrushchev, and this relates to what the war we see now, it was Khrushchev who decided that Ukraine should have Crimea. So he was the one who said that, you know, we're going to give you Crimea, which is something that Putin then decided to take back in 2014.
This episode of From the Roots Up is brought to you by The Torch Club, Sacramento's premier live music venue every Wednesday to Sunday. Check them out at 904 15th Street in Sacramento or online at torchclub.net.
To just circle back briefly to the point about how Putin has attempted to exploit the Nazi narrative. It is something that has, I think, largely been either ignored or misunderstood by much of the Western press. Those partisans who either fought under the Germans or who formed the independent Ukrainian army were not seeking to join the Nazis in a war of extermination of Jews or other people. They were looking for the same thing that people in Western democracies all look for, which is to live free and to have sovereignty and have a nation whose territorial borders are agreed upon by the international community. And there were no question atrocities committed by Ukrainian partisans. And it is not a simple narrative, nor is it black and white. So I don't want to give the impression that it's simply good and bad or anything along those lines. But what Putin has packaged or has sold as justification for his war is a distortion of both history and contemporary politics in Ukraine. He has talked often about neo-Nazis, the threat of neo-Nazis in Ukraine. And there is an element of far-right nationalism in Ukraine. It has never at the ballot box actually reached more than something like 0.02% of the vote. There are no so-called neo-Nazis serving in parliament in Kyiv. But
one could argue that much of Western Europe actually has a much stronger far-right movement than Ukraine at this very moment, right? Like including government coalitions and ruling coalitions of some of the nations of Western Europe. So
yeah, you take the words right out of my mouth. It's absolutely true. There's a much stronger far-right element throughout Western Europe, and one might argue in America. The numbers are much, much greater. And Ukraine has shown itself to be a quite durable democracy, an imperfect one. But since the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, Ukraine has, on at least three occasions, they have staged mass sustained popular protests that have resulted in the preservation and I would argue the strengthening of the country's democracy. I see much of the West going in the opposite direction, where democracy's principles are being chipped away at. And in Ukraine, I see the opposite. I see a younger generation in Ukraine raised on those tried and true values of democracy that have, in some cases, been challenged in older democracies or have fallen by the wayside. And young Ukrainians in particular sincerely believe in the power of democracy. So the narrative that Putin has tried to sell or has used as justification is a work of fiction. And it is sometimes frustrating for me in that I sometimes see the Western press writ large parroting some of that without recognizing that this is disinformation. And particularly after 2014, when Ukraine's military was almost non-existent when Russia first invaded in 2014 in Crimea and southeastern Ukraine. And it was volunteer militias that provided most of the soldiers who fought and held the Russians held them from making deeper advances into Ukraine. Some of those militias, it's true, had far right origins. Western press took some of that and the narrative sort of metastasized. It became, if you look at a variety of different news publications, it became something that sounded as if far-right Nazis were fighting for Ukraine and that was the predominant element, both on the ground fighting and in Kyiv and parliament. And it was such a distortion and such a misreading of what was happening. And I think now, almost 4 years into the current war, that narrative has more or less faded away, except for Putin himself. I don't think that people look at Ukraine anymore as being under threat from within by anything like neo-Nazis. If there is a neo-Nazi in this war, it's Putin himself. He is acting as a fascist who is attempting to destroy an internationally recognized democracy. And it is Ukraine that is upholding, in my view, upholding democratic principles that are under siege, not only in Ukraine from external forces, but under siege from within in many older Western democracies.
From the Roots Up is community radio that is sponsored by community businesses. If you'd like to join the growing list of folks who make this show possible, reach out to Jenny, J-E-N-N-Y, at khi.com. We all know that money spent on politicians is nothing more than a bribe. Citizens United called it free speech, but we know better. But what if we could balance the scale a few bucks at a time? That's what we're doing at the Six Pack, taking small donations and adding them up to make things more fair. Crack open some change. Support the Six Pack. Paid for by the Six Pack, which is responsible for the content of this advertising. www.thesixpack.com. Not authorized by any candidate or candidates committee. If you love live music and want to be up close and personal with the band, there's only one place to go, the Torch Club. This hotspot is the place to be with two shows a day, Wednesday to Sunday. Check out the upcoming shows at torchclub.net or just drop by 904 15th Street in Sacramento. The Torch Club. There's always something happening.
I think for those of us who grew up with this Cold War dichotomy mentality of what the old Soviet Union was, and then knowing that, you know, Putin came out of the secret police of that regime, which was ostensibly a communist regime. But I mean, since 1991, but certainly since there was that purge of the governmental ownership of everything and turning it over to a bunch of oligarchs who are now, you know, basically grafted onto the state. I mean, that is the very definition of fascism. It is the combination of state and corporate power, right? And these oligarchs are nothing if not just giant corporations doing most of the things that the state used to do. So I've had this thing in my head, like I think of Russia as a fascist state in the modern sense of the word, and not a communist state. As you know, I grew up in the 70s and 80s, probably a lot like you, at the end of the Cold War, thinking about Russia and the Soviet Union in a very different way. I guess you, with family situation, you had more context than I did. But I mean, we were thinking like this is the West versus communism. But really, once communism was gone and that whole thing blew up, it became a fascist state, right? And then I guess I would say for the Ukrainians who have been sitting there in the middle of this, watching despot after despot roll over their state and crush their national identity, I can imagine, you know, it makes sense to me a little bit that democracy is so precious to them, because they, for generations, have had to live in the absence of it and really surrounded by the most chaotic versions of authoritarian rule, right? Like, that's what they've seen all their whole lives.
Yeah, it's a kind of terrible national heirloom. Trauma is passed down from one generation to the next. And I've spoken to a lot of young Ukrainians over the last 3.5 plus years during the war about their understanding of recent history and going farther back than Stalin's reign. And almost to a person, their parents or their grandparents or their great-grandparents can tell these horrible stories of loss, of starvation, of execution, of exile. And so they don't learn history from textbooks. They learn it from family.
Talk about biting the hand that feeds. Sitting there
watching. Wow, that was a lot. And though I knew some of the story, I knew it from our perspective, from the U.S. perspective, and I certainly didn't know the insane scale of the Holodomor, the massive famine imposed on the Ukrainian people by Stalin. That was a real eye-opener. I mean, learning that and understanding what that might do to a people really helped me get a greater understanding of what's going on there. And there's even more to come in our next episode. Before we go, I'd like to leave with the opportunity to stand with the people of Ukraine, because that's what we do here. We help where we can. Here are some of the great nonprofits who are on the ground doing the good work. These are the ones that Martin himself can attest are really there getting it done. Let's start with East SOS, founded in 2014 after Russia's initial incursion into Ukraine. This group evacuates civilians from frontline zones and provides an array of supportive services for people displaced from their homes. Hospitallers, or Hospitallers, it's like hospital with an L-E-R-S at the end. This volunteer organization of paramedics has evacuated more than 41,000 wounded troops and civilians since its founding in 2014. More recently, Hospitallers expanded its mission to include animal rescue. World Central Kitchen. In the deadly cold of winter and in the withering heat of summer, WCK has kept Ukrainians alive in a literal and emotional sense, delivering nutritious meals and unreserved compassion. This is true the world round. Jose Andres and World Central Kitchen are an amazing resource. I first saw them on the ground back in, I think it was 2018, during the Paradise Fire. They're fantastic. Razom for Ukraine. This group's vital work includes gathering and sending medical supplies to military and civilian hospitals, advocating for the Ukrainian political cause around the world, and promoting the country's vibrant culture within Ukraine and abroad. And finally, the Media Initiative for Human Rights. Founded by a pair of journalists in 2016, this nonprofit documents and investigates Russian war crimes, seeking to hold Moscow to account for abducting civilians, torturing captives, and other atrocities. So that wraps up this week's episode. We'll be back in our next episode with part two of the conversation on Ukraine with Martin Kuz. I'm Sean Frame, and I hope you'll engage me in a conversation. If you want to reach out to us, send an email to fromtherootsupshow@gmail.com.
Get happy, 'cause nothing lasts forever, but I